Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dune and Philosophy, Minds, Monads, and Muad'Dib. Edited by Kevin S. Decker. Series edited by William Irwin. Narrated by Nas Mehdi and Ariana Delawari. Introduction. He who controls the spice controls the universe. Kevin S. Decker. A beginning is the time for taking the most delicate care that the balances are correct. This every sister of the Bene Gesserit knows. Dune. Frank Herbert's Dune is a space opera treasure trove, and its sequels show it to also be a Pandora's box of latent surprises and long games. In the Duneverse, we explore so many things. Survival, honor, deep ecology, strategy, weird psychic and physical capabilities, psychology, gender, prophecy, religion, and cultural mutation over millennia. But one omnipresent theme in the Dune tales, a theme that also characterizes the popularity of the book series and film and television adaptations, is endurance. Paul Atreides finds a way to endure his tests for taking over the ducal seat from Leto. Jessica and Paul endure the Arrakeen Desert's daily hostility, sand getting everywhere, winds whipping at hundreds of miles per hour, every drop of water needing to be saved, and of course, the sandworms. And the Dune saga endures. Over the 6 books that Frank Herbert published between 1965 and 1985, to the many prequel and sequel books written by Herbert's son Brian and Kevin J. Anderson, loads of fanfic, Sci-Fi Channel television miniseries, and 2.5 feature films and counting. Alexander Hodorowski's Dune was never filmed, but Hodorowski's mid-1970s script adaptation would have resulted in a 14-hour film, and that deserves a little credit. Director Denis Villeneuve's latest adaptation, released in 2021, garnered enough critical praise and audience fervor to justify at least one sequel, even without dipping into the XD Duneverse, mostly constituted by the quasi-canonical writings of Herbert Fils and Anderson, the stories of the great houses of the Landsraad, the Emperors, and the God-Emperor unfurl over a jaw-dropping 16,000-year span of time. That's endurance. The Duneverse began in 2 novellas, Dune World and The Prophet of Dune, serialized and analog between 1963 and 1965. Herbert developed the sands and sieves of what would become Dune, the novel with the editorship of the great John W. Campbell. For the magazine Analog, formerly Astounding Science Fiction, Campbell demanded that his writers try to think out how science and technology might really develop in the future, and most importantly, how those changes would affect the lives of human beings. This new level of sophistication raised Analog above its peers in the dust chasm of SF pulps. And many of the chapters in this book stress the importance of Herbert's careful research and historical, cultural, and ecological themes. Among others, to meet the demands of Campbell's stricter approach, knit together and published in 1965 by Chilton, yes, the publisher of those incredibly detailed car manuals, the Analog novellas became Dune, winner of the prestigious Hugo and Nebula Awards. Dune was part of the new wave of science fiction of the 1960s and 1970s, which was characterized by literary experimentation with shifting styles, differing narrative points of view, and unreliable narrators, and with the integration of elements of the psychedelic culture of the period. Authors like Herbert, Joanna Russ, Harlan Ellison, Philip K. Dick, and Ursula K. Le Guin represent this movement. In the Dune books, plots are often driven by futuristic developments of psychedelic culture, like mind-expanding drugs, Arrakis's spice melange, psychic powers, the weirding ways of the Bene Gesserit, dystopian themes, the culture of House Harkonnen, the genetic manipulations of the Tlay Laxu, race memories and martial arts that allow control of the mind and the body. All are explored in their philosophical richness in this book. Many of the chapters you're about to listen to, rightly emphasized the ecological themes of Herbert's book series. The immersive experience Herbert wished for readers of Dune was based on his own immersive experiences in the Pacific Northwest. John Atariani of Oregon Public Broadcasting wrote, "In the early 20th century, the coastal Oregon city of Florence was under threat of being consumed by the nearby dunes that were being whipped across human structures by the coastal winds. Roads, railroad tracks, even homes were being swallowed up by blowing sand. Starting in the 1920s, the U.S. Department of Agriculture ran a program to try and stabilize the dunes by planting European beach grass. Herbert came to Florence in 1957, planning to write an article documenting this battle between man and nature. He was awestruck by the power of the blowing desert sand. As he wrote in a letter, these waves can be every bit as devastating as a tidal wave and property damage." In turn, the scenarios of Herbert's Duneverse frequently depict not only the uncontrollable power of nature's majesty, but also the sublimity of its vast expanses of space and time. Fans frequently recommend reading Herbert to initiates based on the scale of Dune's world-building. Whether the treachery of twisted Mentat Piter de Vries or the golden path plotted out meticulously by the god-emperor Leto II, strategic and military brinksmanship often takes years or centuries to play out. The great achievement of the 24 philosophers represented in this book is how they deploy their synthetic imagination. Without even needing to convert the poisonous water of life, the philosopher has the ability to see the big picture, how things are, and how they could have been. She can also tease out the implications of the smallest threads of relevance, whether from Herbert's books or from the Denis Villeneuve film adaptation. This kind of guidance, reminiscent of the teaching of Socrates or Hypatia, isn't a luxury when exploring the vastness of the Duneverse. It's a necessity. So it's entirely appropriate to acknowledge the influence on this volume of the first, groundbreaking book about the philosophical themes of Dune, editor Jeffrey Nicholas's 2011 Dune and Philosophy, Weirding Way of the Mentat. When I met Jeffrey at a Spokane Area Ethics Bowl shortly before his book was to be published, I was both excited for its release and disappointed that I hadn't thought to submit a chapter proposal myself. It's satisfying to finally be able to offer up one's own contribution to the enduring Dune phenomenon. A note on the many editions of Dune: as a worldwide publishing phenomenon, there are numerous publishers of the book series, volumes of which have been translated into at least 14 languages. In each chapter, every author has been asked to identify their preferred edition, and references in their chapter will follow that edition.
Songs of Muad'Dib, Culture and Religion in Dune. 1. Liberating Women's Bodies, Feminist Philosophy and the Bene Gesserit of Dune. Kara Kennedy. Maybe Frank Herbert was too subtle in crafting the powerful and influential female characters in Dune, since some readers seem to overlook them. Women are everywhere in Dune, especially the members of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, from Princess Irulan and Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam to Lady Margot and Lady Jessica. Bene Gesserit women's voices and choices play crucial roles in the book. But Dune doesn't seem to be a work of science fiction that promises a future of gender equality. Although set in the far future, it resembles a past of feudal dukes, barons, and counts owing loyalty to an emperor who bequeaths planetary fiefs and favors as he sees fit. In this medieval setting, the women of the Bene Gesserit don't hold the same roles or have the same responsibilities as men. Instead, they still hold traditional female roles: concubines, wives, advisors, and religious figures. Jessica is Duke Leto Atreides' bound concubine, who bears an heir, Paul, and uses her business training to serve as Leto's secretary, while Leto's busy engaging in strategic military planning on Arrakis, she is instructing their new servants how to set up their household. At a formal dinner banquet, she plays the gracious hostess, calling for more dishes and making small talk with her guests. Leto sits at the head of the table and is the person called away when a potential emergency arises. Among the Fremen, Jessica is not allowed to be her own champion when Jaimus calls for a ritual fight. These and many other examples demonstrate that Jessica isn't given the same opportunities or made part of the same action as men. Mohayam is the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV's advisor and truthsayer. She is trusted by him and provides crucial advice during his final confrontation with the Atreides family. But she is not a ruler. She must rely on her authority as a high-ranking Bene Gesserit and her ability to truthsay. She may evoke fear, but she has to channel political influence through others, usually men. The characters Margo and Irulan have more limited appearances, but also appear bound to follow the lead of the men in their lives. Margo travels with her spouse, Count Hasimir Fenring, who is the Emperor's friend and confidant. Irulan accompanies her father, the Emperor, to Arrakis and agrees without resistance to a marriage alliance with the Atreides family. This does not mean the Bene Gesserit are sitting around letting men run the show, though. They maintain a silent partnership in the Chome Corporation and have an agreement with the Emperor to keep a Bene Gesserit on the throne. Meanwhile, they have a nearly covert operation involving a genetic master plan, missionary work, and highly specialized training. Given these factors, Dune appears to create an environment with separate gendered spheres in which men and women often have different responsibilities, activities, and skills. Women have their own thing going on, but they do it behind the scenes and don't occupy roles with overt authority. This is not a universe in which women and men are equal. The female body, friend, not foe. If we consider what's happening with the female body, though, Dune promises more freedom for its women. The Bene Gesserit do not see their bodies as obstacles to their active and purposeful existence in the world. They reject the idea that women are inferior or less capable of doing things than men simply because they're female and can get pregnant. Instead, they embrace the fact that they can choose to birth children and control their genetic lineage. They see vast potential in the body that members of the guild or mentats have overlooked or neglected. The Bene Gesserit view the body as a valuable vehicle through which to perceive the world and achieve their aims. In other words, the body is a way for them to be active agents of their own lives rather than something that holds them back or weakens them. By striving toward a balanced relationship between mind and body, they uncover a possible future in which women creatively utilize their potential to make their mark on the world. Philosophers can help us understand how the depiction of the Bene Gesserit can be considered a science fiction vision of feminism, despite Dune's lack of gender equality. In her groundbreaking 1949 book, The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir, 1908-1986, takes a bold step by saying that girls don't just naturally take on the characteristics and stereotypes associated with femininity and womanhood. There is no inner feminine essence driving their behavior. One is not born, but rather becomes woman. In Beauvoir's view, what happens is that girls are socialized early on to think of themselves as weaker, and so gradually feminize themselves. They are told to be modest, charming, and graceful, to be accepted by society. But though they are rewarded for restricting themselves and becoming proper women, they are also often treated as less valuable than their male counterparts in society. Over time, gendered restrictions and limitations become normalized. So it appears that women are destined by a feminine essence to always have certain attitudes and behaviors. In the world of Dune, the Bene Gesserit have recognized the importance of socialization and flipped it on its head. Under the pretense of preparing girls to be concubines or wives placed in noble houses, they have developed a comprehensive education program that emboldens girls with a wealth of knowledge. In a presumably all-female schooling environment, girls are expected to study and master a broad range of subjects. Jessica tells the Fremen housekeeper, the shout-out Mapes, that tongues are the Bene Gesserit's first learning, and shows off her fluency in Chakobsa, an ancient hunting language. At the dinner banquet, she recalls the Bene Gesserit teacher's lesson on espionage and counter-espionage, while she uncovers a Harkonnen spy. Far from being merely a beautiful concubine and hostess, Jessica is a highly trained woman who actively uses her skills to analyze those around her and determine their level of threat to herself and her family on Arrakis. Yet socialization also includes how girls learn to view themselves in relation to their body. Beauvoir says that in many cases, girls do not receive training in athletics, are forbidden from fighting or climbing or other dangerous activities, and are persuaded to avoid pushing their limits. This can have severe, long-lasting effects on their beliefs and behaviors. For to lose confidence in one's body is to lose confidence in one's self. Beauvoir takes issue with these structures of sexism, suggesting that if girls were raised with the same expectations, freedom, studies, and activities as boys, they would grow up free from feelings of weakness, passivity, and inferiority. If girls and women did not experience their body as something to be ashamed of or a handicap on their ability to do things, they could enjoy a more active and independent engagement with the world, just like men enjoy. They could see themselves as people who initiate rather than people who passively sit on the sidelines. Beauvoir advocates for women to recognize themselves as fully capable human beings and explore the many possibilities that have historically been denied to them. Understanding that an academic education is not comprehensive enough, the Bene Gesserit also focus attention on the body and its potential to empower girls and women. Rather than forbid intense physical activities, they encourage girls to perfect their skills in areas such as fighting. Jessica is more than capable of handling herself in sticky situations. We only get a couple sentences describing Jessica using her skill in a tussle with Stilgar, and it is over quickly. A turn, a slash of her arm, a whirling of mingled robes, and she was against the rocks with the man helpless in front of her. But Stilgar is in awe of her weirding ability of battle that requires no weapons. And this helps show us how amazing her skills are to master an armed Fremen. Her body is the only weapon she needs, having been trained in the art of combat at her Bene Gesserit school. In fact, the Bene Gesserit are actually the standard of measurement for combat. In the appendix in Dune, the definition of the Sardaukar, the Emperor's feared soldier fanatics, states that their cunning abilities at infighting were reputed to approach those of a Bene Gesserit adept. The Sardaukar only approach the skills of the Bene Gesserit, although the Bene Gesserit certainly don't seek out a fight and aren't soldiers. Their special combat skills give them the confidence and strength to move through a dangerous world as women. Iris Marianne Young, 1949 to 2006, takes Beauvoir's rejection of a natural, feminine essence a step further in Throwing Like a Girl, a Phenomenology of Feminine Body Comportment Motility and Speciality. Young looks closely at the female body and how its movements and limitations are conditioned by socialization. She's interested in how the female body orients itself toward its surroundings and why we might already find gender differences in body behavior and movement in children as young as 5. Why should there be such a thing as throwing like a girl considered a derogatory accusation? If the human body is primarily used to accomplish tasks, whether those be throwing a ball, lifting a box, or walking to work, why do boys and men attempt these tasks with more ease and free motion than girls and women? Why are girls and women more likely to experience their bodies as a fragile impediment instead of as a durable instrument that gets things done? For Jung, responses might include lack of practice, lack of confidence, and a woman's perception of herself as being an object rather than an initiator. A woman sees things happening to her instead of her making things happen. She worries about being treated as an object rather than as an equal human being. What is needed is for her to have complete trust in her body to do what she wishes, so she does not see her body as a burden that holds her back. In the Dune universe, the Bene Gesserit give girls so much practice in honing their skills that it almost guarantees they will grow into supremely confident women who trust their bodies to follow through on any action they desire. When Jessica is confronted with potentially hostile Fremen, the Shaddout Mapes, and Stilgar, she secretly readies her body for battle through the waiting whip snap of her muscles. There is no sense that she views her body as something fragile or burdensome. She has full faith in her body to initiate action, thanks to her Bene Gesserit training. Jung argues that if women were not physically inhibited, confined, positioned, and objectified, they could see themselves as agents who could go out and master a world that belonged to them. There is one example of Jessica being inhibited that stands out as a clear contrast to how she normally operates. After being drugged by the traitor in the Atreides household, Jessica awakes to find her mind and body are sluggish, and she has been bound and gagged. With both her and Paul thrown into an ornithopter to be dropped in the desert by the Harkonnen, she must wait for her ungagged son to assist her in getting her gag removed before she can take control of the situation. In this case, she is restricted from immediately confronting the challenge ahead of her because the Harkonnen knew what a deadly creature she is and prepared accordingly. But at other times, when her body is not confined, Jessica does appear to be a woman who rises up to meet what life throws at her. Liberated women. The Bene Gesserit in Dune represent a fulfillment of the ideal of the liberated women Beauvoir and Jung describe. They are a pseudo-religious organization that encourages its members to perceive and use their bodies differently than we might expect of women in a medieval, feudal age, or indeed by the standard of today's societies. Sisters and reverend mothers measure themselves against Bene Gesserit standards, not male standards. In fact, considering gender in Dune from this angle provides a richer and more comprehensive understanding of its women than examining gender roles in terms of equality. If women were given the opportunity to use their full bodily capacities in free and open engagement with the world and encouraged to develop specific bodily skills, they could overcome some of the challenges in a sexist society and make their goals a reality. They could avoid the hesitancy and timidity that can get in women's way. The Bene Gesserit show this in action. The body is a core part of their toolkit, not an obstacle. And everything they do is geared toward a goal, whether small or large, immediate or far-reaching. The Bene Gesserit have certainly developed specific bodily skills, and these extend beyond their more obvious fighting ability. They train in the art of minute perception, honing their eyes, ears, and other sensory organs to notice the smallest of details of their environment. Jessica frequently uses this ability to assess novel situations, the potential for danger, and the best course of action. During virtually every step of her and Paul's journey on Arrakis, they are processing sensory information in subtle ways, using their training to navigate and survive in an often hostile environment. At the banquet, she is following the conversation with Bene Gesserit intensity and reading the body language of key political figures on Arrakis to determine whose loyalties lie where. For instance, she determines that the banker is terrified of Dr. Liet Kynes after hearing the fear in his voice and seeing it in his face, his breathing, and the pulsing of a vein at his temple. In an encounter with a Shadout Mapes, Jessica reads the petite betrayals in Mapes' actions and appearance as Jessica reveals her knowledge of the Bene Gesserit implanted legends while also preparing to defend herself against a possible attack. Her keen perceptive abilities serve her well, as she gains valuable political insights that help her survive and establish a secure foothold on the planet. Another useful skill the Bene Gesserit master is that of the voice. This mysterious ability involves a Bene Gesserit pitching her voice in a targeted way to control another person. It is essentially a voice of command that cannot be resisted without special training. Mohayam commands Paul to draw closer to her when she prepares to administer the test of the Gom Jabbar. She also commands him to stop turning his head to look at the needle at his neck. Paul knows she is using the voice, but he isn't trained well enough to resist it or use it himself. Jessica uses the voice to put Thufir Hawat in his place, literally, and show him a glimpse of her powerful ability to control virtually anyone she wishes. The voice combines skills in perception and vocal regulation to turn the mouth and vocal cords into a vehicle for women to bend others to their will. It is a special ability that only Bene Gesserit women have until Jessica trains Paul to use it, and so it's not something uniquely feminine, but instead a skill that requires practice to acquire. The voice empowers women with confidence because they know they can get things done quickly and efficiently and protect themselves in dangerous situations if need be. It's a kind of shortcut to power, to be used sparingly. A larger scale version of the voice is the Missionaria Protectiva, a long-term project involving Bene Gesserit women traveling to the far reaches of the Imperium to sow religious myths to ensure a safe reception if later necessary. Although we do not meet any missionaries, we can speculate that these women must be sufficiently trained in a number of skills to successfully establish themselves in remote places. They have to survive in body and spirit while also persuading the locals to believe the religious dogma they bring along. On Arrakis, they are so successful that the Fremen even adopt their terms, including Reverend Mother. Centuries later, all Jessica has to do is prove herself as a Bene Gesserit to begin to win the loyalty of a new people. A balance between mind and body. One of the key ingredients of the Bene Gesserit success is their emphasis on balance between the mind and the body. Unlike the Spacing Guild, which prioritizes mathematics, and Mentats, who prioritize logic, the Bene Gesserit embrace a more thorough understanding of their capabilities and talents. They escape the trap of Cartesian mind-body dualism, a philosophy that has filtered into culture to position women on the lesser side of artificial divisions: men, women, masculine, feminine, mind-body, logical-emotional, rational-irrational, and active-passive. Cartesian dualism is named after René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, the French philosopher and mathematician considered to be the father of modern philosophy. Descartes popularized the theory that the mind and body are different kinds of stuff.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?